song. After he died, his mother had to leave town again because her cover was blown. Neil's father saw his picture on the news just like everyone else, and he was on the way to reclaim his wife. Laurel D. was likely to be the valedictorian. She was the smartest girl the school had ever seen. She was too high-strung, I thought, to survive college, but she got high SAT scores and aced her AP tests and joined all the clubs you're supposed to join. She went to the state finals in gymnastics. Credentials don't mean anything to the bullets. They said she was the last one shot. When the shooter was chased by police out of the building, he turned back to fire at them, and a bullet ricocheted off a wall and wedged itself in Laurel's throat. Her best friend tried to close the wound with her sweater. This is how we got the most famous image of the day. Laurel's best friend, blood smeared on her face and her chest, collapsing into the arms of Laurel's boyfriend, who was covered in dust from one of the explosions. Laurel's body on a stretcher, already dead. Both the best friend and the boyfriend would be overwhelmed with guilt for having survived, and even though they were trying to live normal lives now, they were both at different colleges, knowing that the fact of their existence was a fluke. When Hannah J. was 15, she went on eBay and tried to sell her soul. She wanted to save up to move to Scotland and start a new life. She briefly became national news. She was a clever girl, but a terrible student. She had this anger that nobody could control. Once, she flipped her desk when a teacher asked her to repeat her answer. She got in terrible fights with the other girls over the pettiest things. My mother told me that in the bleak of winter when you see your breath, you're actually seeing your soul, and you have to suck it back in before it escapes. For years, I tried to hold my breath while I was outside, terrified by the thought of accidentally misplacing my soul. And sometimes I would rush past strangers and try to chomp down on their vaporous breath to stockpile extra souls just in case. If you don't have a soul, then you're just a pile of bones and muscles. I don't know who bought Hannah's soul, but I know she died without one. And when I'd asked Reverend Chet what that meant for her, he'd shrugged and said it didn't matter. He'd said souls were a myth. Carly T. was the last of the students to die. She'd spent 3 weeks in intensive care. 4 surgeries, many pints of blood transfused. Neighbors and concerned strangers stood vigil beneath her hospital window. She ended up living for 9 weeks before dying of complications related to the surgeries. The media showed her cheerleading photo while talking about her grades, her popularity, her hair. She was pretty and young and white, and people got sadder about pretty dead white girls than any other type of dead person. She was much more complex than the small-town Barbie they wanted her to be. She'd had a few arrests for drug misdemeanors. She and her boyfriend once stole the principal's car. Her parents were joyless and distant. Her mom had chronic back pain and was over-medicated. Her dad meant well, but was limited. Carly T. had a blonde ponytail that bounced when she jumped, and she had perfect teeth. Good teeth are enough to overcome a lot of problems. We are civilized and have developed all kinds of ways to judge the depth of another's character. But mostly, we go by the show of teeth and the shine of hair, and that's it. Go to the zoo, and you'll see the same thing. The lion with the beautiful mane gets the lioness. The buck with the biggest antlers gets the harem of doe. It's as rational a system as any. February. Calvin was in my kitchen, cooking dinner while I watched TV. He had worked as a chef for several years because restaurant work is one of those fields where being a drug addict isn't necessarily a drawback. Give a man good knives and fresh fish, and suddenly he thinks he has superpowers. After rehab, Calvin had settled into a very safe, comfortable job, where he wore khakis and a polo shirt and did things with spreadsheets. There was a time when it was very important to me to eat good and trendy food. I knew the names of the hottest restaurants. I tried the unfamiliar ingredients. I drank the recommended wine pairings. But when you live by yourself, it's hard to care about food. It's hard to motivate yourself to make a complex meal, because there is nobody to share it with. You eat the microwave dinner, because it's there and you need to stay alive. On TV, they cut to live footage of a standoff at the clock tower on Main Street. An armed militia had claimed the land and declared themselves an independent nation.
"We are here to protect you,"
their leader, Pinckney Benedict, announced.
"You do not understand it, but we are preserving your rights."
Behind him, the militia held their guns in the air. One of them waved a flag. The militia members were screaming at a reporter about how the Tree of Liberty must be refreshed with the blood of tyrants. "I think I would be a really good tyrant," I said.
"I've always had faith in you," Calvin said.
After dinner, we went to the clock tower to see the militia. The police had roped off a perimeter, and the captain was negotiating with Benedict via megaphone. They were 9 men and 1 woman, plus a few bored-looking children. They wore camouflage uniforms and helmets, and had amassed an impressive arsenal of weapons. The list of demands was long and unrealistic. The president would not abdicate to satisfy some angry rural people who had commandeered a useless clock tower. The police would not jail all people this group suspected of being terrorists. Mayor Randy would not deputize the militia and give them authority to police the area. I recognized half of the militia members, even in their war costumes. Benedict was in my high school graduating class. I had slept in his house twice when I was a teenager, after parties when I was drunk and afraid of going home. He'd been nice and accommodating, and so respectful of my personal space I barely knew how to handle it. One of the younger men had mowed my lawn for 3 summers before moving on to college. When the cameras were off, everyone was calm. As soon as they switched to live TV, the militia started screaming and pointing their guns at the police. The militia had assumed the public would be on their side, but everyone was making fun of them. Only one of their demands had been met. Pizza delivery every afternoon from a pizzeria that sympathized with their cause. They'd brought supplies, but not enough. At night, they camped in tents while 2 sentries kept watch. If anyone got within 100 feet, they shouted warnings and pointed their guns. It was inspiring to see them at least committing to something. Calvin wanted to go to the movies. We used to go to movies with my father every weekend. My father sat by himself in the front row, while we sat a few rows behind him. He laughed so loudly at jokes that people shushed him. During intense scenes, he leaned forward so far in his seat, it looked like he was hoping to be sucked into the screen. I watched the back of his head, craned up at the screen while he shoveled popcorn into his mouth. I didn't have any idea what he loved or why. Calvin would always get up 15 minutes into the movie, saying he had to go to the bathroom, and then sneak into a different theater. My father never knew he was gone.
"I just need to get out of the house," he said. "I want to do something."
I patiently explained to him the problem with movie theaters, the fact of being trapped in a darkened room with the exits so far away and easily blocked. Had he not even heard about the movie theater shooting in Fairhope, or the one in Phoenix? There aren't any safe spaces, but there are less dangerous places. And besides, what is the point of movies? What good does watching a story about fake people do anyone?
"You're no better than them,"
Calvin said, pointing at the TV. The militia members were milling around aimlessly. They sometimes paced just to create a show and keep a camera on them. The world is not out to get you. I never said it was, though I thought, what if it is? Your paranoia makes you not even human. It just makes you this jagged shard of fear that can't do anything. I turned off the TV and stood. If he wanted to do things, then we would do things. I put on a jacket and some shoes and told him to follow me. If we got killed, it would be on him. I drove Calvin to the loudest restaurant in town, and then I invited Robbie to join us. I hadn't seen Robbie for 2 weeks, and he was getting frustrated. He texted that if I didn't get back to him soon, our relationship was over. I felt bad for him, and also I didn't want him to go away. I hadn't specifically thought about it in those terms before, but I realized it was true. I felt better with Robbie in my life than without. I was afraid to tell him that. He didn't respond to my first text or my second, so I sent him a third. I have a younger brother. I want you to meet him. He was there 15 minutes later and ready to ask more questions than I was comfortable with. I'd asked for a table close to the open kitchen, so every clang and shout would drown out our conversation. The TVs were tuned to a college basketball game. The clamor and nonsense of the basketball fans made it hard to focus for longer than a few minutes. Robbie wanted to hear stories about what I was like as a child. Oh, Christ, I wouldn't even know where to start, Calvin said. He laughed. He laughed now more than he ever had when he was young. I wondered sometimes if he even had a right to laugh after everything he'd done and gone through. How did it not grind him down into nothing? Let's start with this. What did she used to do for fun? It wasn't always like this, he said, looking at me while I gulped my wine. You know what she used to do? She would take me out in the yard and play with me like we were pirates. We dug so many holes out there burying treasure. No, Robbie said. There is no way she played along. Our dad got so pissed. We would take his stuff and bury it. One day we took this watch that I guess was worth all kinds of money. When he realized it was gone, he made us go out to dig it up, but we couldn't find it. I was supposed to make the map that time, but I must have lost it. The restaurant was not loud enough. No place is loud enough when you want it to be. She was always like that, Calvin said. That imagination, man, it was trouble. Robbie said, sometimes I'm not sure whether I want to see what it's like inside her head. They laughed again. They were becoming friends. They'd been together for 15 minutes and had already formed a bond over how I was crazy and they were not. Soon they would be staring over my shoulder at the TVs and talking about basketball. They would speak in the secret language of men bonding over nothing. I can't believe I've never met your brother before, Robbie said. I pushed my menu to the center of the table. Are we ready to order, or would you rather just go home? I said. By the end of the meal, I was drunk. Normally I would go back to Robbie's place, but Calvin was there to drive me home. He and Robbie did a complicated handshake hug maneuver that men seem to know automatically. I hated the idea of them being friends. On the drive, he said, is it like this every night? I reclined my seat as far as it would go. He stopped the car in the middle of the road. He shifted into park. No one was around us. Come on. How am I supposed to know what it's like? I turned the radio back up. I need you to give me a real answer. It's been cold for a long time. You've been gone too long to understand. My breath tasted terrible. In the morning, I would hate myself. Overnight, I would wake up and try to count the drinks I'd had, try to round it down. I would start counting out the reasons I wouldn't have a drink the next day. I would map out the coming days when I would, or would not, be expected to drink, and try to determine whether I would be able to stop myself.
"Fuck,"
he said. He shifted into drive and pulled a U-turn. I unbuckled my seatbelt. He tried to reach over and buckle it. He was a father now, I remembered. A man who had children and took care of them. He knew how to drive safely while also reaching with one hand across the car to tend to a child.
"Drive faster," I said. I wanted him to go so fast I couldn't see,
and then slam on the brakes and launch me through the windshield like a cartoon character in an ejector seat. I wasn't paying attention to where we were going until we were there. He pulled into the school parking lot and turned off the lights, but left the engine running. In the dark, it just looked like a normal school.
"I thought it would look worse," he said.
"The ghosts are all inside."
After it happened, I had dreams about the school for weeks.
He lit a cigarette.
It was fucked up. I hadn't even thought about this place in forever. And then every night I was dreaming I was a kid in the halls, and I was so small nobody could even see me. Then the bell rang and everyone started chasing me, trying to stomp on me. I woke up before they ever got me. I didn't tell Nina about it, I just wanted it to go away.
I have never known what you're supposed to say when someone tells you about a dream.
I was hoping you would call, then. That you were just here getting drunk by yourself.
If you look over there, I said, that's where the memorial is going. By the cafeteria. It's going to be grand. The word felt luxurious, working its way up my throat.
I have to go home. Nina's worried about me out here with you.
In phase 2 of the War on Violence, the Anti-Violence Task Force called on everyone to become citizen journalists. The best way to catch the bad guys before the next atrocity was to record everything. Even if we didn't prevent an attack, then we could at least film the scene as it happened. The news didn't work anymore, and the police didn't know how to stop the murders. When institutions fail, it's on the people to pick up the pieces or be crushed beneath the rubble. I used my phone to record everything I did. It was hard to imagine how people had ever survived without constant surveillance. I watched other people's live streams, hoping to see something, so I could then say something. All around me, people were flipping through videos of non-crimes filmed by other citizen journalists. But most people's lives, most of the time, are a long string of nothing. It is no thing, then no thing again, in a row, for hours. At night, I was entranced by how dull my own days were, especially with my brother gone. Sitting in coffee shops, looking out the window for suspicious people, walking to the post office, avoiding the cracks in the sidewalk, exchanging money for soft drinks and sandwiches, ordering one gin and tonic, then another at Murphy's Law. Sitting in the passenger seat of Robbie's car as he drove down Main Street, past faces that were both familiar and alien. If you caught a video of a murder in progress, you could go viral. You could get a small paycheck from the news producers. You could create content, which helped to create other content, which helped to create jobs for thousands of people. The media's appetite for video was insatiable. It needed filmed death to stay alive. The second meeting of the peacekeepers occurred 3 weeks after the first. Norm's neighbor, Charlie, joined us. Charlie was younger than Norm, and looked like the sort of man who spent his youth at rock concerts and inside dive bars. He was the kind of man who has hundreds of indistinguishable stories about high school parties. I took notes, while he ran through the list of suspicious activities he'd observed in the past week. Charlie offered to drive us on our first official patrol of the neighborhood. On the rear windshield of his truck, he'd affixed more than a dozen stickers, many of them different versions of a famous comic strip character peeing on something he didn't like. Democrats, a particular football team, his ex-wife, the EPA, a soda company. Another sticker said, "My family," and beneath it, there were four guns of various sizes, meant to represent the father gun and the mother gun, and the two gun children. There was something I could respect about a man willing to so openly broadcast his anger. At least there were no secrets. We drove for 2 hours, cruising slowly with our lights off so we could get the drop on criminals in the act. I sat between Charlie and Norm on the bench seat of the truck. When we turned right, I leaned into Norm, and when we turned left, I leaned against Charlie. Their guns slid across the dashboard on every turn, following me. You don't even need a hand to shoot someone. Guns sometimes fire themselves because they need a release. I'd read enough stories about children accidentally shooting themselves. An unexpected bump could result in 2 bullets to my chest. Norm fell asleep, his face pressed against his window while he snored. Charlie rarely spoke. He chewed on an unlit cigar and changed the radio stations every couple minutes. I got into long text conversations with Robbie, pretending I was in my house, but feeling too sick to have him visit. I didn't want him to know about the peacekeepers, because I didn't think he'd understand. The peacekeepers did their rounds 2 evenings a week. We never found any criminals, though we did frighten some teens who were drinking in the woods. Norm wanted to bust them so he could at least feel productive. But Charlie wanted to buy them more beer. "They could be like informants," Charlie said. The teens ran as soon as they saw our flashlight. It was unclear whether our efforts mattered at all. "What even is the fucking point of trying?" Norm said one night before he fell asleep. "Maybe they know we're on patrol," I said. "It's like a preventative thing."
"Great. Let's give the key to the city to the guy who saw nothing happening," Norm said. "I don't even think that key works on anything," Charlie said.
The receptionist in the municipal building had worked there since I was a child. I'd known her face my whole life. A neighbor boy once told me she was a witch, 200 years old. He told me if I ever made her angry, she would put a curse on me. I later realized this wasn't true. But still, I didn't like taking chances. I rushed past her, my eyes directed at the floor, and I ignored her when she asked where I was going. I pushed through Mayor Randy's door and slammed it behind me. The way he reacted to my entrance, I realized I was the town's new witch. I was the one who would put curses on people. This was a power I'd never felt, and now I understood exactly why the witches in fairy tales would be so willing to wreck people's lives. You do it because you want people to know who you are. You put the children in an oven, not because you're hungry, but because you want their parents to understand the feeling of having no control. Randy retreated behind his desk and instantly looked more comfortable.
"Anna," he said, "you shouldn't just show up like this."
He gestured to an empty chair, and I sat. "I want to talk about the memorial," I said.
"I'm afraid I can't do anything about the memorial," he said. "We've already hired a sculptor. The project is in the hands of the state now."
I couldn't understand why the state would have any say over such a thing at all. He shrugged.
"It's a hard thing to explain. Everybody wants a piece of it."
I told him my idea anyway. What I envisioned was this. No memorial at all. No stone. No American flags every 3 feet. No ribbons. No priests and no Bible. No symbolic floral arrangements to represent vitality or youth or rebirth. No poet reading a poem about rising from the ashes. No obelisks, for God's sake. Just dig a huge hole and fill it with guns. A hole so deep you could see the magma bubbling beneath us. Have everyone come from around the country and throw their guns into the hole. Fill it up with nitrate-rich soil. Fill it and fill it and fill it until the hole is overflowing. Then walk away. Allow the earth to process the guns and turn them into something beautiful. The earth can turn coal into diamonds. Imagine what it could do with guns. Wait until the guns sprout from the ground and flower, and see what new resources present themselves. After the flood, you get rainbows. After the fire, you get mushrooms. After the shooting, you just get more shootings, unless you do something different. He shuffled papers on his desk.
That's a very interesting idea, he said.
Can I tell you how tired I am of people telling me I'm interesting?
I can't. I wouldn't even know how to begin.
And what would the EPA say? I think the EPA would be happy not to see more children get killed.
He dropped his head in his hands like an exasperated parent. Look, there's a public meeting next month. Come present your idea. Do not say I endorsed it.
The sculptor of the memorial was a graduate student at one of the big state universities, and she looked like she was 17. Some days, everyone looked younger than me. I saw their faces and couldn't even imagine what it felt like to be so young. She had a crooked smile and hair that flowed past her hips. She wore clothes that didn't fit her, and when people spoke to her, she stared at the ground and chewed on her fingernails. Her eyes never stopped darting around her. In her tininess and frightened alertness, she reminded me, more than anything, of a bird. I watched her when she took a tour of the site, sketching ideas in her pad, while the men of the town council spoke to her. I couldn't hear them, because I was watching through binoculars, but I knew they were droning on about the spirit of the memorial, about closure and healing and memory. I knew she wasn't listening to them. The next day, she returned by herself to work on some sketches, so I drove to the school. I had nothing I wanted to say to her, but I also felt strongly that I needed to meet her. She did not look up from her pad when I approached. I told her my name, and it meant nothing to her. I told her I'd been falsely accused of the shooting.
I don't pay much attention to the news, she said.
Why are you here?
This is kind of a big deal for me. It's my first commissioned sculpture.
How lucky for you that all these people died, I said. She finally looked up from her pad. I could see she was terrified of failure. She'd chosen an impractical major in a world that holds the arts in contempt. It was an unfair thing for me to have said, but it felt good to hurt somebody. When you say something cruel, your brain releases a surge of dopamine to soothe you. And then your body starts to crave the dopamine, so you become progressively meaner, just to get your fix. What she was doing was pointless. It was just the next step in the playbook of a mass murder, and we needed to get through it so we could check it off the list.
What the fuck do you want me to say to that? She said.
I hoped she would say something terribly hurtful. I wanted her to cut me so deep I would have the scar forever. Women can wound each other in ways men can never imagine. She sat down in the grass and kept sketching until I walked away. On the 9th day of the standoff at the clock tower, one of the militia members accidentally shot himself in the foot. The sound of gunfire could have caused the police to panic, but they did not. They calmly approached and offered medical assistance. One of the militia's founding principles was to oppose government in all its forms, so they refused the help. I was in the crowd watching as they waved the ambulance off. I hated the part of me that wished someone else would fire a gun. I hated the part of me that could watch this happening and forget it was reality, wishing for terrible things to happen for the sake of my temporary entertainment. My online therapist blocked me the day after Calvin left. She said I was being too needy, but there were plenty of other places online to bare my soul. I tried commenting on New York Times articles. On an article about economic sanctions on a Middle Eastern country, I wrote, "Sometimes I feel guilt for things I've never even done, and then I feel guilty for even feeling that guilt." Someone responded, "LOL." Someone else responded, "Did you even read the fucking article?" Of course I'd read the article. What did that have to do with anything? On an article about increased security measures at airports, I commented, "I guess I've always felt alone. I know that's why people get pets, but I'm sort of afraid if I get another cat, I'll love her too much. I'll scare her off because I'll be this concentrated beam of needy love energy. My last cat hated me so much, I didn't know how to handle it." Nobody responded. On an article about rising taxes, I commented, "I feel good today. I woke up in the morning and felt lighter, smarter. I looked in the mirror and didn't hate myself. I had a good breakfast. I thought about the world and how lucky I am, relatively speaking. I want to feel like this more often." Someone responded, "What the fuck is wrong with you anyway?" Someone else said, "Maybe you should feel bad. Life is shitty, and you're shitty for bragging about your privilege." Being online wasn't safe, exactly. But it was safer. Or maybe it was just dangerous in a different way. Weird little communities clustered around the most obscure interests. You could belong and not belong at the same time. Robbie said he couldn't stand the glow of the laptop in bed, so most nights I was confined to the couch. Across thousands of websites, I left comments, scraps of my personality, as if my whole life had been printed on paper, shredded, and tossed like confetti out into the wind. On car repair forums, there were notes about my brief period as a high school field hockey player. On fashion blogs, there were snippets about my junior prom. On the box scores of basketball games, there were descriptions of freshman dorm life. "Haven't you heard of identity theft?" Robbie said. "Why can't you just get a journal?" The thought of compiling it all in one place was dreadful. Being able to pick and choose when and where information was distributed, being able to control the story by scattering it, that was the only reasonable approach. With Calvin back home with his family, I suspected he was texting Robbie behind my back, and I suspected Robbie of spying on me. He was relentless in trying to get me some kind of help. He signed me up for 2 different support groups, one for survivors of trauma and one for depressives. In the morning, he woke me and coaxed me through getting showered and getting dressed. And then he made me lunch. And when I asked where he was taking me, he said, "You don't get to ask questions. This is non-negotiable." When we arrived at the local Methodist church, I worried he was taking me to get baptized. I'd been baptized as a child, and it had done nothing to help me. Robbie had called Renee and asked her to chaperone me, so she was standing at the door of the church. She needed help as much as I did. I didn't even know Robbie had her phone number. He was prepared to chase me down if I tried to escape. But the truth is, once I passed through the front door of the church, the most difficult part was over. When I looked over at him, the hard set of his jaw, the defiant look in his eyes, I thought for the first time that I might love him. I didn't love him, but right then, I felt like I did. I was impressed by him. I acted like I hated him for it. I thought he might feel cheated if I went easily. This was a heroic moment for Robbie. I thought it would be cruel to ruin it by making it too easy. The group, 15 people including me and Renee, met 3 times weekly. Nobody asked me about the shooting unless I brought it up. Nobody ever accused me of anything. Mostly, what I did was sit and listen, and sometimes cry. It's a paradox that surrounding yourself with more misery helps you to feel better. If you can't breathe, the best thing you can do is sink yourself deeper into the sea and wait until you grow gills. That's just evolution. Here, everyone understood the fear, and I was able to tell them that every day I felt afraid. Every day, the act of leaving my house felt audacious. Even in a church basement, I worried I might be the victim of an elaborate trap. And what they did, every time, was let me talk. When I left the meetings, Robbie was waiting in his car to pick me up. Jenna O spoke to our support group one evening. She had been shot 3 times at the school and lost so much blood that they didn't think she would ever regain consciousness. She awoke from her coma after a week. She'd lost the use of her legs. She would undergo 10 surgeries in the first 5 months to try to ameliorate the damage to the nerves in her hands, the scarring on her face. She would look like a victim for the rest of her life. Had I been her, I would have gone into hiding. But she kept speaking. She appeared on the news and she took the podium at the many vigils and rallies. She became a spokeswoman for the anti-gun movement. Sometimes she received threats from people who were very concerned about how her disfigurement might inconvenience them. The surgeries had fixed her face in an expression of permanent disgust. She had been a weak student, distracted and immature. But now, she was a different person. During one speech, she spoke compassionately about the boy himself. "I've read everything he's ever written," she said, "and it breaks my heart to know that he was so unhappy and we were right there. We are surrounded by people like him, and we need to stop pretending everything is fine." In the church basement, she told us she knew how hard it was to overcome the fear and the sadness, but that we had a moral responsibility to do so. Sometimes she had to pause because her brain didn't quite move at the speed it used to. Sometimes she slurred her speech. She kept saying, "Everything happens for a reason," as if this fact had ever been in doubt. Then, she listened. I felt ashamed to be sitting in the same room as her. I felt unentitled to my own emotions. I felt like a failure for having even had any negative thoughts about life when mine was so much better than so many other people's. Everyone wanted me to get better, which meant they wanted me to stop being sad. But being sad was the only thing I needed. The real problem is when people flinch from the sadness and hide. Men see a sad woman, and they want to fix her. But in fixing her, they flatten her emotional life under the weight of meaningless platitudes. I left the room, and Renee did not follow. Robbie was not there yet. I ran. I was embarrassed to go home and tell Robbie I'd left the meeting. I was sick of explaining myself. I picked up 2 bottles of Crown Royal and walked to the clock tower. I thought the militia guys might get a laugh out of the crown thing, since they were so opposed to monarchy. But they didn't even think about it. Pickney Benedict frisked me, and then opened the bottle.
"Did you bring any cups?"
he said. They were overall an uninteresting group of drinking buddies. They didn't want to have conversation. They just wanted to lodge grievances. I would have been better off sitting in newspaper comment sections, because at least I could have closed the tab when I was done. At this point, the militia was very weak. The children had long ago lost interest in playing army. The man who'd shot himself in the foot was in incredible pain and kept saying they were going to have to amputate his foot.
"I'm sorry you think liberty is worth less than your damn foot, Gary," Benedict said. "You said we'd be done here in a week," Gary said, "and I'm out here dying like an asshole."
Benedict called everyone into formation for the shooting of their daily video. He asked me to hold the camera because their tripod was broken. He addressed their followers and asked for supplies.
"This is George Washington in Valley Forge time," he said.
"The winter cold without a sun was enough to kill you. The heat lamps did very little to help."
"This is a chance for a true patriot to save us."
I wondered how many people were skeptical of Washington and Jefferson and the others when they were out making trouble for everyone. I wondered if I would have been on the right side of history if I'd lived then. Benedict's son was a precocious, angry little boy. He had a seemingly endless supply of rocks to throw at nearby businesses. His name was Constitution.
"You'd never see the president name a kid Constitution, would you?"
Benedict said. I agreed he probably would not do such a thing. I found it easiest to agree and agree until I was too drunk to really listen. Without sunlight, it was hard to tell if it was morning, but the others were already milling around, trying to look soldierly, while I rolled out of my hungover sleep. The media had gotten bored days ago, and some had already left town, but there were a few cameramen on site. It was going to be bad for me if anyone recognized me standing in the so-called Freedom Circle. I turtled my head into my sweater and scrambled away from the scene, knowing it was already too late. A state trooper cuffed me before I reached the sidewalk. On the news, there was footage of me pressed to the ground, an officer's knee in my back.
"Former shooting suspect arrested," they said.
Robbie had to bail me out. They cited me for disorderly conduct, public intoxication, and three other quality-of-life crimes I don't remember. I faced a court date and owed a $3,000 fine. I did not have $3,000. The unemployment had lasted 6 months, and my savings were almost gone. Calvin was still sending me checks, but I was not cashing them. At that point, I was unemployable. My face and name had been connected to a school shooting and now another arrest. My choices in this town were limited and unpleasant. The only real choice I had was to leave. I'd gotten used to Robbie looking at me like a disappointed parent, but as he led me out of the station, hand gripped hard around my elbow, he seethed. He released me when we got to his car.
"I'll give you a ride, but you can't come to my place," he said.
He still looked so young, but in his eyes and in the patch of gray stubble on his chin, I saw his future. I saw him with close-cropped hair and business casual attire, his sleeves rolled up precisely to his elbows as he sat down for a happy hour drink with a client. I saw him wearing shoes instead of flip-flops. I saw him talking to the client about his new dog and his new baby, and how it's been a little crazy, yeah, but we're adjusting. We're surviving. I saw him yawning at 5:30, and then heading home, walking instead of driving because he'd had two drinks, and anyway, it's a nice night out, and he could use the fresh air. I saw him entering his home, and seeing his wife feeding the baby. and then running around in the yard with the puppy for a few minutes before giving his wife a break. I saw him cleaning the baby's face and then tossing it casually up in the air several times and smiling, and then later laying the baby down into bed. I saw him 15 years later, holding his daughter's hand and telling her he was proud of her and trusted her. But please, let him know if the new boyfriend ever gets fresh with her. I saw his whole life flashing before my eyes, and I knew he was going to turn out to be a very good man. He already was a good man. I was not part of his future. "If you're going to get in the car, just get in the car," he said. He couldn't even make eye contact. I had him drop me off at Murphy's Law. I knew once I got out, I wouldn't see him again. And I had no idea what I was supposed to do to change that. March. One day, the confession booth was replaced by a mailbox-shaped robot. The robot had a message written on its chest. "You are being watched for your safety." It swiveled in a full circle periodically, but never left that corner. Seldom Falls had been chosen as the recipient of one of the first public security robots in the nation. This was a pilot of a program called Sentry, safety ensured nationally through robotic yeomen. "Where did the booth go?" I asked the robot. "I can only answer questions about safety," the robot said. "You must get lonely out here." "This does not appear to be a safety-related question." "Do you have a girlfriend?" "Warning sign, erratic behavior. Please report to hospital for evaluation." I did not like the attitude of this robot. At the high school, they conducted random locker checks for contraband weapons, and students who were categorized as aggressive were quarantined in classrooms where they couldn't disturb the other students. As part of a program called Never Again, they spent Friday mornings quietly reflecting on the sadness of violence. Students had to sign a pledge vowing to defend their peers against all attackers. They held shelter-in-place drills, during which they practiced being shot at, but safely. After 2 months, nobody had been shot. Our state senator's approval ratings were higher than they had ever been. He pushed for this school safety plan to be adopted statewide. But before these policies, we had previously gone many decades without a shooting. Some people confuse good luck with strategy. After a car bomb in San Francisco killed 7 and injured a dozen others, the country went on high alert for terrorist attacks. It was impossible for me to ramp up my vigilance further, but I tried. I texted Calvin to ask if he was okay, and he said he was fine.
"LOL, why the hell would terrorists attack Seldom Falls?" he said. "Like you could even tell if someone set off a bomb there."
Terrorists liked to attack places of financial or symbolic value, and Seldom Falls was neither. It made sense not to worry about it, but it also made sense to look for terrorists everywhere, to continue recording every step I took, just in case. If the attacks were predictable, then nobody would ever be killed by them. People wanted to treat the violence like the weather. It was there, inevitably, and they felt that with enough advanced equipment, they could predict where it would strike next. The possibility of the violence not existing had not occurred to anyone. When I was young, before my brother lived with us, there was a rash of small bombings around the country. I wasn't supposed to know about it. Adults assume kids don't pay attention to the news, and maybe some don't. But after my father left for work, I sat at the table with a newspaper spread out in front of me. I liked highlighting words I didn't understand. I liked both knowing and not really knowing. The police said it was a loner, planting bombs in objects that looked like debris. He would leave something that looked like a wood scrap in a parking lot, and when someone bent to move that wood scrap, it would explode. For months, I lived in fear of normal objects. What I feared most were things that didn't look like bombs, because those were most likely to be bombs. My mother told me I couldn't live my whole life afraid of everything. Now I understand that most advice people give is actually directed at themselves. My father spent nights with me walking through the neighborhood cautiously, classifying items as bombs, non-bombs, or bombs disguised as non-bombs. Once we identified a safe object, he would walk up to it and touch it first, and then I would touch it too. We never blew up. If we found a bomb, my father wrote the exact location in his notepad and promised to call the police when we got home. One night, he spotted a strange unmarked box on the curb. I was certain this was the bomb that would explode us, and I held on to his shirt, telling him we had to go right away. But he kept walking, and as he approached it, I ducked, because at school my teacher had told us explosions move upward like heat. I started crying, because I knew my father was about to die. He touched the box and shook it, and then lifted it over his head like a circus strongman. He dropped his flashlight in the grass, and so from my vantage point, I saw his legs illuminated and a dark place where his face was. The box was full of old golf trophies. My father shook the box around, and I felt reassured then. Not everything explodes. Most things don't. I was 24 when he killed himself. He stood up early from Easter dinner without a word, walked out into the backyard, sat down on a tree stump, put a shotgun in his mouth, and pulled the trigger. We heard the sound, and Calvin was the one who saw him first. He was only 16, and had been home from rehab for a month. He would overdose for the second time that night. I saw my father's ghost trailing around in the backyard as if nothing had happened. His ghost is gone now. I used to see it back there when I drove by, but a few years ago it dematerialized. The night of my father's second death, I cried so violently, I thought it would detach the ligaments from my bones. The public meeting about the memorial opened by wasting time on various state officials taking their share of the credit for the planning of this event, and municipal officials soliciting donations. If we could do this for free, a councilman said, we would. But listen, things are not free. If we just gave memorials away, everyone would want one. This was followed by several speeches about the importance of properly honoring the dead. Everyone wanted their chance to announce exactly how the shooting had affected them. When finally I had the opportunity to speak, I made the same suggestion I'd made to Randy last month. I knew before I finished my first sentence that they wouldn't listen to me. I continued anyway. I said a memorial's greatest value is in showing us how to avoid this kind of tragedy in the future. I said that what we really needed was a mural of all the police looking the other way while that boy strolled by armed with the arsenal of a small army. People died because of you, I said. You let this happen! I hadn't planned on saying that. Most of my thoughts spent very little time in my head before they made themselves known. Sometimes I don't realize my thoughts are mine until I hear them. I felt the hands of security guards on my shoulders, and I had to make a choice. Leave calmly and with my dignity, or continue shouting as they dragged me away. Dignity is overrated. Given enough time and enough tragedies, we will eventually run out of places for new memorials. Every square inch of the planet will be covered by plaques commemorating a war or a shooting or a building collapse or a massive fire. We will be reminded of the inevitability of tragedy But when you try to make it impossible to forget, then there is no point in remembering.
Angie and Reverend Chet stopped at my house.
We decided to give you one more chance, Angie said. Reverend Chet entered my home without my permission and unrolled blueprints on my table. They explained that I was seeing the blueprints for an apocalypse bunker, already in construction deep in the woods an hour from here.
Needed my help. My labor, primarily, but also donations. Canned goods, bottled water, blankets, fitness equipment.
Chet showed me the blueprint. I pretended I understood how to read blueprints.
It looks good, I said.
It was one of the best-designed apocalypse bunkers I'd ever seen. They said they had a master carpenter building out the walls now.
I did not envy her job. To be a carpenter for a Christian church is a significant burden, considering the lineage.
For the bunker to work, God would need to launch an apocalypse, but forget to look underground for survivors. The Old Testament God was a foul-tempered teenage boy. He was a C student, constantly being tricked and distracted and outwitted. He'd forget about his creation for millennia, and then come back to it looking to take out his hormonal rage. Chet was a big believer in this God.
This seems like the sort of thing a cult would do, I said.
Angie looked at me like I'd just said something very stupid.
Well, yes, of course it is.
The idea that all cults are bad is a myth, brought to you by Uncle Sam, Reverend Chet said. Jesus himself was considered a cult leader in his day.
But they killed Jesus, I said.
And they'll kill us too if we let them, he said. To be classified as a cult would be an honor.
The idea of hiding underground for a few years until everything got better was appealing. That's why groundhogs look so happy.
Can I have a few days to think about it? I said.
Angie laughed at me.
No, honey, no, she said. You've proven yourself untrustworthy. We're just here for donations.
I gave them a few cans of soup, and they left.
Reverend Chet had preached to us once that if we truly believed, and we committed to taking action, then we would be just like Noah.
I didn't want to be Noah. Noah was a bad person. Noah was a coward. He should have listened to God and then told him, "No, I like it here. You don't get to kill everyone just because you screwed up."
Instead, he abandoned them all and floated away to safety with his menagerie of giraffes and walruses. Noah had to build an ark, because God decided to kill everyone on earth. And then later God apologized with a rainbow.
It doesn't add up. The apology does not have the same weight as the bodies.
A group of teenagers used a live stream to record themselves raping a girl at a party. A man in Little Rock went on a killing spree and streamed every murder as revenge on the woman who had recently divorced him. He broke into the homes of senior citizens and made them kneel on the floor. He made them beg, made them say the name of his ex-wife.
Then he shot them and looked into the camera and said, "This is your fault."
I tried not to watch the killings, but everywhere around me there were screens. In line at the bakery, I heard a man shouting, and looked just in time to see the video playing on the phone of the teenager in front of me. He and his friends watched the murder over and over, with dead-eyed curiosity, the way they would view any other piece of viral content.
Anything can be entertainment if you watch it enough. The value of your life is directly proportionate to the number of ads they can run before the video of your murder. This particular murder had garnered over 1 million views, so it had been a very good one indeed. I tapped the teenager on the shoulder and asked him to turn his phone off. He looked up at me and smiled. Then he made a motion with his hand like he was jerking off. He turned his phone off, but he and his friends laughed at me. I stayed in line.